These are the drums of a shaman. And if you find yourself falling into a trance, well, that's the whole idea. Because for the Olche people of far eastern Siberia, everything is alive with spirit. And no one has studied the Olche more than our guest today, Jan van Eiselstein. She's written a beautiful 500-page book called Spirits from the Edge of the World. It's all about the Olche and their amazing ability to channel spirits in mind-blowing ways such as this.
How are these people able to be the way they are in the world? You're in a house with them and things start flying around. Cups and saucers that'll fly around in the house, or lights get exploded. You're out with them in nature and things start to happen. You know, animals, wild animals come up to you. Or you're downstairs in a sealed room and they're talking about the north wind and everything is sealed and locked, and suddenly there's a wind in the middle of the room. It's like, I'm still in the how is that done?
So, of course, the natural question for Jan. Okay, well, then where's your fucking iPhone? Where's your iPhone, Olche? I'm being crude, but you get the point. If it's about going to these extended realms to make your life better or to help your people or to help them pass to this journey to the next or the underworld or to avoid negative people, well, then I'm doing the same thing. I do it on my iPhone. Where's your iPhone? Stick around for a great chat with a great guest, my new friend Jan van Eiselstein, who's written a terrific book and isn't afraid to stand up to tough questioning that drives at the bigger questions, the deeper questions of shamanism and how it connects with this extended consciousness that we keep running into. All that and so, so much more coming up on Skeptico. Today we welcome Jan van Eiselstein to Skeptico. Jan has written a very impressive new book titled Spirits from the Edge of the World. And she's here to join me in a conversation about shamanism and all sorts of related good stuff. Jan, we're doing take two of this interview. We did a little audio change here, but thanks again so much for joining me on Skeptico.
Thank you so very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is a repeat, but we're going to try and get right back into it because we started a few minutes ago and now we're doing the audio again. This is a really interesting topic, and you were so generous to contact me, and you've listened to the show Skeptical, so you know what it's a little bit about. And you said, Alex, I think we should talk about this amazing work I've done with these group of people, these native people in this remote area of Siberia, and they're the Olche people. And as we were just chatting a minute ago, they are really the original shamanistic culture. That is where the name, the origin of the word shamanism comes from, is these and the surrounding culture, right?
Correct, yes.
So you've done this incredible deep dive into their work, and I have to tell people that the book is really great, very well written, nicely compiled, and then I go to your website. It's absolutely beautiful. You have these beautiful infographics with all these teachers from the tribe, and you have them laid out in their lineage, and you have some great audio and video that you've collected. So I guess the place to start again is to give folks a sense of how you came to study these people, and what was the process like? And you just told me it's taken you a number of years. You've had these folks come and visit you for over 10 years, and you've learned their language. And tell us the whole story, if you would.
Okay. This fall of the Soviet Empire, people in Russia are allowed to have their own passports. A gentleman named Viktor Bondarenko, who had lived in that area his whole life, comes to the United States. I owned a bookstore and gallery at that time. He comes into my bookstore. He wants to give a lecture for 3 nights on these people that he has worked with. And he talked to me a little bit about it. And I thought, okay, I've never heard of these people. Okay, sure, Viktor. We'll set up a forum for you. He comes to my bookstore, and for 3 nights, he talks about these cultures, and I am just elated. I'm gobsmacked. I'm thinking, who are these people? These are amazing. The Ulchi.
Okay.
The Ulchi and also the Nanai people. He worked with both cultures. So I asked Viktor, I said, hey, Viktor, when you go back home, would you see if the people themselves would be interested in coming to the United States? They had never left their villages.
I mean, again, explain, Jan, because we were just chatting a minute ago. This is a remote area, kind of off the Korean Peninsula, close to the Korean Peninsula, if we wanted to give people a geographical sense.
Actually, even further north, across from Sakhalin Island, close to the Hokkaido, which is the northernmost island of the Japan chain. So they're that far.
Yeah, right. I was just trying to reference it in a way that people might understand. But no, I appreciate what you're saying. So he's giving this lecture. What had he done with these people? Why was he interested in them? And then why were you interested in this? Were you interested in shamanism? Were you interested in, you know, kind of these kind of practices from a applying them standpoint? What drew you in?
Well, he is a trained musician, and he was going up and down the Amur River region. He fell in love with the people, and he started actually, because they don't have a written language, he started recording their ancient melodies and their ancient songs and writing them down so they wouldn't be lost. And so that was his connection to them. And then when he came here and he talked about these remarkable people, I just thought if we could get them here to the United States, it would be an amazing event for people to come and really meet these people and see them and learn from them. I had no interest in shamanism before he came to my bookstore, and so after that happened, they started coming to the United States for 25 years, sometimes 2 and 3 times a year, to give lectures and talk to people.
What was that like at the beginning? I mean, what would they come and talk about?
Their culture, what they believed in. They would come and talk about, if people ask, they would talk to them about ETs. They would talk to them about their ancient petroglyphs, their rock art. They would talk to them about how they perceive reality, what shamanism is and what shamanism isn't, especially when they came to be introduced to the way shamanism is being portrayed, especially here in the West. And so they just came and answered people's questions. They never actually, you know, these people never stand up at a podium and give a lecture. They just will arrive in a place and they'll say, okay, what do you want to ask? And that was hard initially for Western audiences, because Western audiences are used to going in and having their little notepad or their little recorder on and waiting for the lecture to happen and be very passive. But it wasn't a monologue on their part. It was a dialogue with people. So you had to ask questions, and they would answer the best they could.
So your book is a compilation of all the things that you learned. What are some of the highlights? You just teased a couple of great things. You know I'm going to ask you about the ET thing, but let's start with the shaman thing, since you just mentioned it. What did they feel a need to clear up in terms of what Westerners think about shamanism versus what they think about shamanism? What is their understanding of their practice, their shamanistic practice?
But it's not even, for them, it's not even a practice. It's something that's natural. It's something, it's not about techniques. It has nothing to do with techniques.
Okay, but it is about, I mean, one very early on in the book, and this is interesting vis-a-vis what you just said, is there's this hidden knowledge. There's this secret knowledge that is only passed on, like right at the beginning of the book, you say, you know, the grandmother or whatever says, hey, I learned it. In 10 years, I thought I knew something, but I didn't really know anything. And then 20 years later, you know, right when they're about to die, they go, okay, kid, come on in. Now I'll tell you the real stuff.
Right.
So there is, you know, it's a way of life, but it's also like, hey, everyone knows this, but let me tell you what's really going on thing, you know?
Well, first of all, there's no shaman school. So they believe that the only way the skill or the art is given to you is by the spirits. You don't go to a teacher. Now, if there are elder shamans around, there are people that have been doing the art for a long, long, long time. You go to them as colleagues. If you get confused or you are having some events happening to you while you're in the other worlds, they might give you a few hints. They might give you some ideas how to correct that. But they always say you ultimately need to listen to your spirits. Your spirits will teach you. So there's, first of all, there is no school. And at the very end of a shaman's life, when they're willing to pass on some information to a colleague, say, that is still alive or maybe halfway in their developmental stage of the work, I have no idea. I have no idea what they pass on. I think they leave you with more questions than answers. You know, what they'll do is they'll give you perhaps a map of the territory. But once again, as we all well know, the map is not the territory. You have to go and explore it yourself. So they'll give you some hints and some ideas, and let's try this out and try that out. You might look for this, and when you see that, and that's that.
So again, let's frame this up from big picture standpoint.
Okay.
They are connecting with this extended consciousness world, this world of the spirits, right?
Well, yes, they believe that reality is relational. And it all goes back to their idea of the guest-host relationship, or what they call in Greek, xenia. But you find the guest-host idea in many cultures. They believe, first of all, that we're not outside of nature. They believe that we're always in direct conversation with spirits or other things that are surrounding us. The consciousness is like a big radio dial, okay? And you've got the baseball station here, and you've got the NPR station here, and you've got the classical station here, and it's all going on simultaneously. But it's all relational. It's like you're just sort of tuning in to different frequencies of consciousness. Let me just give you an interesting example. Intuition. They do not believe that people have intuition in the way that the West thinks of intuition. They don't believe that it's self-generated. So if you're sitting around and you're thinking of your mom, or you're thinking of your cousin or friend, and the phone rings and it's that person on the other end of the phone, in the West, they would possibly describe that, oh, you had an intuition that that person was going to call you. They would say, oh, no, that it doesn't work that way. They would say your spirits came to you and said, hey, your mom's just about to call you, so get ready. So it's all relational. Intuition is not a self-generated process, but it's always in direct conversation with something else.
So that really gets to the big question that I have and the main thing that I wanted to talk about, because I don't care about the Ulchi. I'm never going to meet the Ulchi. And I care only in the sense of what they can inform in terms of all my other kind of things. And all these competing ideas we have about this extended consciousness reality, right? So the Ulchi say one thing, the NDEers say another thing, the ET says another thing, the astral travelers say another thing. I mean, are we looking at just a different cultural overlay? You know, it's the map versus the territory thing. How do we figure that out?
Well, I don't think so. My concern with a lot of people that go specifically into this field is that they go, you know, they go gather up all this data and they come back and they translate what they think that they've observed from a very mechanistic, linear, reductionistic Western approach. Okay. I think that's kind of putting the cart before the horse. Personally, to really understand another culture, you have to liberate yourself from your own culture as best as possible. And you have to go into another culture and know that you know nothing. You know nothing, Jon Snow, right? You're completely ignorant. You need to learn to think in a different way.
Why? I mean, let me challenge that in a skeptical kind of way. I mean, this is kind of the shut up and calculate model alternative, right? So the shut up and calculate Western model is screw that. No, I'm just going to go plow ahead with my way of trying to mechanize it, trying to operationalize it, trying to make it work. So I don't really care about your culture. Show me an iPhone.
Right.
Or in this case, you know, to connect it with the Skeptico thing, I'm the United States intelligence and I say, go get me Andrei Petraich, go bring Yuri Geller over here. And he seems to know a bunch of this stuff and bring him to Stanford Research Institute. And we're going to talk him in because, you know, kind of you long time ago, past life or former life, you were in that world. So let's bring Yuri Geller over here. And he seems to be able to read minds. He seems to be able to do this. Let's make it happen. Let's remote viewing. Let's figure out how to operationalize that. I don't care about the Ulchi. I only care about what they can do. And I only care about if I can turn it into a product.
Yes. That's an interesting take on things.
And my point is, where does that get us as opposed to where does it get us from taking an anthropological, let's value their culture, let's do all the rest of that? I mean, I'm not saying one versus mm-hmm. the other. I'm just saying let's not prejudice one versus the other, because at the end of the day, a lot of times what it really comes down to is what we want is just the goods anyway. I mean, the whole magic thing and the interest people have in chaos magic, which is in some ways related to this, is I want to get the spirits to do shit for me here in this world. That's what a lot of people, that's their net takeaway. And I think we need to have a reasonable counter to that in terms of saying, well, here's why you might want to do that. Here's why you might not want to do that.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. I think now I wouldn't say that research in the West doesn't conform to the Ulchi reality construct. And I've studied a lot of the Robert Monroe's work,
right,
fits hand in glove with what the Ulchis believe reality is about. The Ulchis believe in multiple souls. They have a very different view. Everything about shamanism in the West by neo-shamanists seems to be interpreted from a very Judeo-Christian standpoint.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, they always talk about the singular soul, and then they talk about this thing called soul retrieval, which doesn't exist. I don't mean to offend anyone, but it doesn't exist in shamanism.
What does soul retrieval mean?
Oh, that in the West, they believe that if you have some sort of trauma, that some part of the personality, the psychological personality is wounded and goes missing and causes all sorts of dysphoric states in your being. So shamans go and find that particular piece, that very mechanized view of grabbing some piece of yourself that's gone missing, and they bring it back and they reattach it to your being, and everything is hunky-dory.
But again, if we go down that path, and I don't know how far we want to go down it, don't we run into the same problems of language, culture, you know, Jungian psychoanalysis, that on one hand is total bullshit, and on the other hand is provably effective for people in terms of overcoming trauma? So if I'm able to make you feel more whole, whatever that means to you, then do you really care whether I called it soul retrieval or whether I called it post-traumatic stress disorder correction or whatever? I mean, does the language sometimes get in the way of something that is so much more complex than we could possibly understand? That,
well, I don't know if it's more complex. I just think it's very inaccurate.
So then let's talk about that specifically, how we would know what's more accurate.
I am only here to tell you what these people told me. And I think that by being with them for almost three decades, learning their language, and the language is everything, that I can come back and translate that back to my Western culture in a way that most Westerners can.
Great.
I can say, okay, what does exist in the medical literature and in the psychology literature and all sorts of other literature that's out there that corresponds to what these people say? Robert Monroe's idea of this second body corresponds hand in glove with what the Ulchis say our beingness is all about. Everybody working in the lucid dream community, that also corresponds to what the Ulchi say is a true shamanic journey.
So how specifically does it connect with Monroe's second body, and how specifically does it connect with the lucid dreaming, astral travel kind of understanding?
Robert Monroe talked a great deal about what he called the second body, and that the second body had a tendency, when he talked about, he had his own designations, but he would talk about locale.
Yeah, he had these
one.
Crazy rooms, room this and room that.
Yeah, and locale one. But I understood what he was trying to get about. Poor Robert Monroe. I mean, the poor man, if you really read his whole history, you just feel for him. Just, he had no idea what any of this stuff was about. But good for him that he did his best to try to document these experiences. So this second body, when it's in this particular state, or we'll say vibrational frequency of consciousness, whatever, is something that is on the earth, and that you can go around and you can be in your house and you can go visit other people and you can do this and you can do that, and you can actually have conversations with other people that are actually alive on this earth, but you will remember it, but they're not going to remember it. Okay, this is something interesting that the Ulchi say is true and is real, and that is that this second soul, or the second body.
Your astral body. So it's the same thing as this astral body. You go to sleep at night, you're in this astral realm, and then if you lucid dream, you're in this astral realm, and then a further extension of it is you actually leave your body, you're outside of your body, you're looking down on your body. Okay.
Yeah, and I'm just saying, these two aspects of Robert Monroe's research, it's like, yeah, they say that's normal, yes, and everything that they speak about or talk about conform to those same exact ideas that Robert Monroe set forth many years ago. The lucid dreaming community and Stephen LaBerge out of, I don't know, he's not with Stanford anymore, but he used to be there. I think he's retired or something. He you know, his research, Robert Wagner's research, Ed Kellogg's research, they, you know, they speak a great deal about this other realm. Well, that is what an actual shamanic journey is. Everything that I can determine from what I've learned from these people and how they've explained things to me is that a shamanic journey has nothing to do with going into some sort of meditative state.
What do you mean by that?
Well, people sit around and they go boom, boom, boom on their drum and they enter, you know, and if you put machines and wires on their head, I mean, they will enter into some sort of calmer alpha theta state. That's something that can be mechanically observed by researchers, that you kind of drift down into a different state of consciousness. Well, everything that they have told me corresponds more with the fact that a traditional shamanic journey is, first of all, being able to enter through the hypnagogic state. Now, we all go through the hypnagogic state every night. And in the West, in medical literature, they call that a hypnagogic hallucination. But we all drift off. And if we are able to keep our consciousness somewhat active, we'll start seeing faces and images and geometric patterns. Everybody does that. It's natural. You don't need to teach that. So they enter through that realm of frequency or consciousness. Then they are able to launch into what I think, from what they've told me and what I understand, is a wake-induced lucid dream, but they're able to shut off the muscle atonia that occurs with everyone at night. And do you get the sleep paralysis? Okay. Now, what I find to be very curious is that in the medical literature, in the sleep parasomnias, there is a condition known as REM sleep behavior disorder, where people go into the state and they get up and move.
Right.
And they're running around and they're moving and they're doing things, and sometimes they're hitting their partner, and which is not good. And all sorts of things occur. And that if you wake them up, they're able to recall everything that they've done. So my understanding is that's what a shamanic journey is, and not everything that's being taught out there. You enter through a hypnagogic state. You're able to control wake-induced lucid dreaming to a point, or the REM sleep behavior disorder, and you come out through the hypnopompic state.
Interesting.
The other interesting thing about this medically, Alex, when you look at the medical evidence on REM sleep behavior disorder, first of all, it can occur in children, but most of the time the onset of it comes when people are in their 40s and 50s. When you look at the Ulchi tradition, people do not take up the shamanic call until they're in their 40s and 50s. And if you look at all that medical literature, you can just go through and just check off everything one by one, the types of experiences that the Western medical sleep researchers have been able to document, and everything that goes on with this shamanic journey experience.
Okay. I have a direction, if you can't tell already.
Okay.
But I'm trying to. No, I didn't mean that in like asking for an apology. Far from it. I guess what I'm saying is I'm driving towards something that I'm curious about, and you're filling in a lot of the blanks. You know, to jump right to the end, I guess my big picture question is, what are we looking at when we talk about these extended consciousness realms as opposed to other extended consciousness realms? So, like, is this the same realm that ET is in? Is this the same realm that NDE is in, near-death experience? Is this the same realm that is the spirit world, past life regression world? And then, most interesting to me, because I'll tip my hand here and tell you that, you know, it's interesting what you said about meditation. And I think my understanding of it is there's a real misunderstanding, because I'm a yogi guy, right? And I think there's the same kind of misunderstanding of what's going on with meditation / enlightenment / awakening and all that, is that what I hear those folks saying is, yada, 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 I'm interested in transcending all of that stuff. So what I hear the yogis saying, what I hear the enlightenment people saying is, you can go there. You can go on your shamanic journey. You can go to use your entheogens and, you know, do all this crazy stuff and talk to ET. We're interested in kind of jumping past that, because that's just another place to get stuck with the fascination of the mind and the mind that wants to attach to all these different things. So I've kind of bundled a couple of questions there, but maybe you can pull them apart. One is, what are we to make of the limits of this extended consciousness realm? What are their limits? And is there a spirituality, if you will, that kind of is beyond?
Well, I'm sure there is. And I don't think that you would have any indigenous people say, well, sure, it's out there, but we don't know about it. It's so beyond our ability to comprehend. I would say that the idea of going beyond, as far as enlightenment is concerned, or it's like, oh, why get stuck in these other levels and be enlightened? They don't see the purpose of human beings having anything to do with being enlightened. They're much more Taoist in their philosophy. It's like we're all a part of the ocean, and you're a wave, and I'm a wave, and everybody else is a wave, and I'm waving at you in the ocean, you're waving at me, and it's about a joining, but it's not about going beyond and becoming one with everything. So they have a very, as I said, it's not about enlightenment and becoming one with God, and that you lose your individuality. They do not believe in that.
Okay, well then, where's your fucking iPhone? Where's your iPhone, Ulchi? I'm being crude, but you get the point. If it's about going to these extended realms to make your life better, or to help your people, or to help them pass to this journey to the next, or the underworld, or to avoid negative people, well, then I'm doing the same thing. I do it on my iPhone. Where's your iPhone?
Well, good. Good for you, Alex. And you do it in your own way.
Not me. No, I don't mean it. I don't
There's
have
no purpose. See, now this is another thing as well. When you start to examine, you have to think like people from the East. And people don't like to hear that an Eastern way of viewing everything is that the universe is meaningless through and through. There is no purpose.
Right. That I get. If you've listened to the show, you know, I always reference Amma, the hugging saint. I admire her work from one level. You know, she's just tireless in her work. You know, she's hugging thousands of people. I don't know how she does it. She's up for, you know, 20 hours at a time, just giving, giving, giving. And then when you talk to her devotees, they say in India, it's even more. She's out there digging latrines, and then she's doing this, and then she's doing that. And one of her devotees went to her and said, Amma, you tell us that there is no world, and that this whole thing is an illusion, and yet you're working tirelessly to make this world a better place. And her response is, world? What world? So to me, that is holding both, you know, in some beautiful way that I can't understand because I'm not spiritually developed enough, holding those two together at the same time, is that one, there is no purpose, there's no place to get, we're all caught up in doing, and
correct,
it's not about doing anything. So, but on the other hand, and even in the Ulchi and in your book and in, you know, there is a doing part to the spirit thing. It's not like we're leaving the spirits just up there. We're saying, oh, come intercede in this, help this happen, help that help happen, help this person in their healing or their recovery or their protection. So that's doing too. So it does, there is kind of a mixed thing to
pull. Well, they are rather ambiguous, aren't they?
Well, I think it might point to maybe a little bit more of a contradiction there that we're willing to accept.
I just think it's fascinating. I don't want to get into, I can see where Amma, and she's an amazing person, is coming from that Hindu background where they view the world as a play, that all the gods are at play and this is all Maya. That's one way of perceiving reality. You know, indigenous people have a different way of perceiving reality.
Some indigenous people, right?
Yeah.
I mean, right.
Right. But yeah. And it's all quite unique and it's all very different.
So where's your iPhone? When I say where's your iPhone, and I think you get it because you didn't come jumping through the screen and throw a fit like a, because I'm pushing pretty hard there and I appreciate that you're willing to do it.
Keep pushing.
So back to connecting the dots, like I was saying, I go and I talk to a guy who's doing a film about Andrei Petraeus, right? So Andrei Petraeus is this kind of brilliant guy. He's interested in all these extended consciousness realms. He's the first one to go to Mexico and look at the indigenous people down there who are using sacred mushrooms, who are using these entheogens to do these kind of astral travels, and they're bringing back all this stuff, and they're also having psychic experiences and all the rest of that. So he's working at he's a PhD, Northwestern University. He's also a medical doctor. If you don't know the history, Northwestern is tied into MK Ultra, which he didn't know at the time, but so they're interested. Our government, our secret shadow government is interested in all this extended consciousness stuff too.
Correct.
And they're probably interested in it because in 1940, 50, they start finding out that ET is in this extended consciousness realm and ET's all over the place. And then later on, they have Rick Strassman, who they allow to research DMT out there in New Mexico.
Right.
And he starts giving it to people and they pop into this same realm, if you will. And there's ET and there's all these shamanistic, if you will, to use the more broad term,
right, you know,
beings and purple jaguars and, you know, all these half crocodile, half human kind of things. So they're all there, right?
Right.
So more interest on the part of our iPhone guys. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying this is our Western kind of, we're going to just drill into it kind of thing.
Okay.
So they're like, okay, great. We got to figure this stuff out. So we got Petraeus, we got Rick Strassman, and Petraeus, you know this guy in Israel, Uri Geller, great, go bring him over here. We're going to study him. He says he can read minds. Well, he can do it. So they're doing the shut up and calculate, build us an iPhone, help us get into that other realm so we can beat the Russians, if that's really the thing, or we can control the population so that they don't get into that thing.
Right.
But they're taking a very mechanistic Western iPhone, shut up and calculate way to reach this extended consciousness realm. And I'm very interested in that because I'm interested in the intersection between that and ET,
right,
who seems to have mastered that in a more technological way where they have tools, they have devices, they have ways of getting into this realm. And the way it leads back to the Olche, and I guess my big question is, when we look at the Olche, when we look at these indigenous people, are we looking at more advanced technology or are we looking at less advanced technology? And if we allow the crudeness of that question to like sit there for a while, are we saying that, you know, well, these people, they figured some stuff out, but they didn't really know how to do it in the same way that they knew agriculture. But to be honest, we do agriculture a lot more effectively now, even though we fuck up the planet. And even though we put in all these crazy additives, we get 100 times more bushels of corn than they do. So are we looking at a more advanced ability to manipulate extended consciousness or a less advanced way?
I would say that the Ulchi are a very elegant, sophisticated form of primitivism. I would also say that as far as contact with other realms, they do talk to ETs. They just call them the sky people, and they see them on walking in the earth, and they also see them in the other realms. And that they have lots of information to impart. But to them, they don't talk a lot about it because it's just second nature to them. I remember when they first came here and I showed them, I said, okay, this is great. These people have never left their village. It's great. I'm going to ask them a million stupid questions, right? So I show them a picture.
Because they're a clean slate, right? They haven't been indoctrinated by the culture kind of thing.
Right. They're as clean. I mean, nothing's clean, but I show them ET and I go, you ever seen this? They go, oh yeah, that's the sky person. Oh yeah, that's the sky people. They said, look at our petroglyphs. They go, oh, those people in the rock art and archaeologists, they come along, they look at our little images of our people of this, and they call it a shaman, or they always misidentify our petroglyphs. They say, no, it's a sky person. And if you look at their mask, which is very interesting, they're all sky people. They don't have animal mask. They don't have mask of birds or wear a mask of this. They're all this oval shape, and they say they're all the sky people. The old mask that they wear.
Is their tradition of the belief that the Ulche are the Ulche descendants of the Sky People? Is that part of their belief?
Of a specific, say, other group, a genetic group? No, they don't have that in their idea.
What is the origin of the Ulche? Where do they think they came from?
They think they grew out of the earth, that the great sky master or sky beings or the intelligence of the earth, that they have all sorts of creation myths in their tradition. So they blew they as I said, rather than having this Judeo-Christian concept of being made like an artifact by some big supernatural being, they say no, they just grew out of the earth. They're much more, or we're a part of nature. We're not separate from nature. We weren't made by, we aren't an artifact.
Right. And of course, as we were talking about a minute ago, we would never know completely because they're telling us from the beginning that some of this is hidden and cloaked because that's the way it needs to be conveyed in order to preserve the message over time. I mean, are you familiar with Laird Scranton and his investigation of the Dogon? Because some of the parallels I thought are just stunning in terms of when I read your account of the Ulche is one, it's an oral tradition, and we've been trained to kind of immediately have a reaction go, oh, you poor stupid people, you didn't know how to write stuff down. And then, Scranton, Laird Scranton reveals, well, they kind of did that by design, really, because they wanted to preserve the integrity of the message, and they found that the best way of doing that for over a long period of time was the oral tradition, because when you write stuff down, you're much more prone to misinterpret it and not get the full story. And the other thing he said that I thought matched up well with your investigation of the Ulche is he said this kind of hidden thing, like you're saying, is like, they tell to the first level of initiate that this is the Dogon, that, oh yeah, we do that ceremony every 60 years. And then he says, after you've been in it for a while, you realize they always have an excuse for doing it every 50 years. And then that what it really is there's a reason behind why we do it every 50 years. And there's also a reason why we tell everyone we do it every 60 years. So in the same way, I guess we always have to have that, we'll have to hold back a little bit of doubt, or maybe I'm jumping ahead. Would you agree that the Ulche, as much as they're telling us, they're only allowed to tell us so much in a certain way, or not? Do you think they're kind of telling us just everything the way they
No,
got it?
it took a long time for me to even get them to speak to me. and not think that I was some sort of silly Western dilettante. So it took a while. And they give you information when they feel like it. And you can ask them questions all day long and they'll just ignore you. So when they feel like giving you information, they do. And when they don't feel like giving you information, they keep their mouth shut. So I don't know if it's something planned, except to say that they will intuitively or instinctually know in the moment. They'll just, you know, they never ask people, what do you think about something? They think that all linear thought should basically be flushed down the toilet. It's all about, how do you feel? You had an experience. How did you feel? They say that in the feeling is your answer. When you have the experience, you're going to fail to really completely understand the experience if that is followed by any sort of verbal commentary in your head. You just have to have, once you get into verbal commentary, you're lost. You over intellectualize. You have a tendency, as they would say in the East, to put legs on a snake, i.e., you make things much, much more unnecessarily complicated.
You know, I thought we might return for a minute because I kind of blew right past it. And I think you said something rather profound when you said that at the end of the day, how you would characterize their culture as primitive. But what did you add to that? Because I don't think you meant primitive in the sense of a derogatory term.
No.
So expound on how we would understand them as a primitive animistic culture.
Well, yeah, I called them an elegant, sophisticated primitivity. And I would say that it's there's a simplicity. There's not the overthinking. There's not the, you know, need to get into trying to intellectualize. But there are these amazing subtle nuances to the way they behave and experience reality that I cannot put it to words. I would say that if you wanted to look at a culture that came close to the actual expression of the Ulchi culture, I would say you would have to look at the Japanese.
You know, I guess what I'm still driving towards, and this is the argument, the debate that I get into with folks who are really looking deeply into the ET thing, which I think is super duper important, especially at this time, because at this time in our culture, we are looking at disclosure, right? So 1217, New York Times, ET is here. If not ET is here, the UFO is here, right? This runs in the not only New York Times, the Washington Post, CBS News, Fox News, everybody. Okay, so they're trying to roll out ET. And there is this technological component to it. There is this threat of AI, of singularity, of ET being further along, but us catching up. And I always counter it with some of the same lines that you're talking about, in terms of, I say, hey, as a yogi, I mean, one of the fundamental things is that I understand that I don't have to do anything. I am just, my being is enough. I don't have to do. Doing is kind of a misstep to begin with. But how do we effectively, and I don't know if effectively is even the right word, we do have this pressing technological component, both in our culture, but also in this extended consciousness realm, who says, no, what you're really looking at, Jan, is very primitive. And as soon as we figure it out, then we're going to leapfrog past all that stuff anyway. And that's, I guess, what I'm wrestling with back and forth.
It's not as though the Ulchi are some sort of isolated group that live way the heck out in the middle of nowhere, where there are no roads to get there. I mean, you have to go up there through the river, and you only get a certain amount of time because, you know, 6 to 8 months out of the year, there, you know, it's ice flow, and you can't even get up to where they live.
It's as close to being out there as you can get.
They love all the new stuff. They just, their culture is a living culture that just says, yeah, we all grow and adapt. Don't think that they don't have cell phones. They have cell phones. That, they love the technology. I mean, one of the favorite things they would come here and be here, and they really appreciated the fact that I could get on the phone and call for Chinese takeout, and they just thought, oh, that's great. People deliver food to your house. That's wonderful. That's super good. Otherwise we're out in our gardens or we're out hunting. They just thought that was terrific. So they're not anti-technological. I remember a group of UCLA students that came back in the 90s to interview them. And so this film crew showed up and they were asking them all these silly questions and looking for some sort of kind of Christian apocalyptic, what does your culture say about some upcoming apocalyptic event? And they just looked at these people like, what in the heck are you talking about? And they were saying, oh no, they go, oh, nuclear power plants, that's okay. This is okay. They just say it just has to fit in with nature. You can put a little nuclear plant over here, and as long as it doesn't spoil the water or disturb the animals or do that, it's like, that's cool, that's great, I mean, that's wonderful.
Now I'm starting to wonder about the Ulche.
Why? They grow, they adapt, they say, listen, the only way to be in the world...
Nuclear power plants were always a bad idea from the beginning.
But I'm just using that as an example to just give the idea that they're not anti-technological. They think, oh, good technology, great. Okay, that's wonderful. Well,
but see, I guess I'm using it as an example of the same, of nailing down the primitive thing, because I totally get what you're saying on one hand in terms of elegant, sophisticated, primitive. But I also want to throw on the table in just a very kind of direct way, primitive in the sense that they don't understand stuff that other people who are in this extended consciousness realm do understand.
Oh no, they do understand. They have, the intelligentsia of their community is mighty and varied. They're very intelligent. They know how the West thinks. They understand. And they understand. They think it's great, but they choose. It's a choice to live a much more simple life, a much more relaxed life, to not be a culture that is driven by greed or necessarily a personal accomplishment, or they aren't people with high anxiety like people are in the West. They cannot believe how anxious Westerners are. They just have a different, simple lifestyle. And that the simplicity comes from, not in the Christian sense of the term, like when St. Francis was talking about, living a life of poverty. It has nothing to do in regards to expiating one's sins. It's learning to live a simple life or be in the world because it's just a happier way of being.
Yeah, I don't know.
But if you want to go out, if you want to go out and do all this stuff, that's great. If you want to go out and do all this stuff, that's great. They're not going to make a value judgment about it. They just have their own belief when it comes to how to be a good human being on this planet.
Yeah, I get that. And I get the Tao thing. I also get the yogic thing. I also get the Neem Karoli Baba thing. Walk around with a broken bowl on your head and be a total renunciate, because that's the only way I can get clean of the thoughts and the cultural indoctrination and all the materialistic indoctrination. I have to totally remove myself from that. And then I cross over to some other understanding, which so many wisdom traditions have talked about. And then we get back to the enlightenment thing. And then I know everything, and I can then pick and choose what I know, what I believe. So to me, what all that means is there's a lot of different ways of understanding the topology of the full spectrum of consciousness. And I always come back to, what are we looking at when we look at any particular group like the Olche, when we look at their understanding of full spectrum consciousness? What are they including? What are they leaving out? And why are they including it and or leaving it out?
Okay, they would say that we all instinctually and or intuitively feel that there's a different dimension to ourself and to nature. They would also say, but it's hard to grasp because it's too close, it's too general, and it's too all-encompassing. And that is reality. And that what we're doing is that we're in constant dialogue, we're in constant interaction with all of consciousness at any time. And we're just attuning our thoughts to this realm or this realm or this realm. It's not that they believe, say, for example, that their spirits are archetypes of other spirits that exist everywhere else. Of course not. Every spirit or consciousness, for example, every time they would come here, the first thing they would do, we would have to go visit our friends over on the Suquamish Reservation, the native peoples here. They would go to the native peoples and request, we have come here. We are on your land, in your space, with your spirits. Do we have your permission to call our spirits over here? So they, through the years, they developed a very intimate relationship to the people here. Consciousness, you're never going to pin it down. You know, I've got to just keep doing my work. And then I think about your podcast, and I know, I'll make a knowledge claim here. I know that 100 years from now, people are going to be listening to your podcast. And I'll tell you why. Because you get all the best people, and you're getting the best people. It reminds me of when I, in the 70s, and I was off to Esalen Institute every weekend to listen to Alan Watts or Stanislav Grof. And these are people in the early part of their career, really just developing their ideas. And a lot of the people that you've got, they're at that same place. They're coming up with their ideas. They're doing their research. And 100 years from now, people are going to look at the guests that you've been able to get onto your show, and they're going to say, oh yeah, you know, there were all those podcasts way back then, and they're going to go, but you got to check out this, you got to check out Skeptico, because this guy was an amazing podcast person, and he brought all these amazing people to the beginning of their careers and their ideas. I mean, I think that is fantastic.
You are way too kind to say that. So now we are challenged.
Okay.
You and I are challenged to produce just such an episode here. And you've given us a lot of good pieces. But I want to return to something that you just said a minute ago, because I thought it was really interesting. And I want to approach it in this kind of skeptico kind of way. And I keep beating on the same drum here to do a play on the very cover of your book where there is the drum beating. And I want to know also, what is the connection of music to all this? But that's probably a whole other thing. We'd probably talk an hour on that.
It creates a frequency, a vibration, the idea of sympathetic resonance, which holds true too to consciousness. You know, if you think a certain way, or if you're thinking about things, that said, that consciousness has its own kind of sympathetic resonance, and that it will attract similar fields.
Okay. Related question. So the Olche come here and they say, we'd like to connect with native people from your land. So two things. One, they're kind of stepping over our culture, you know, for the last couple hundred years and saying, well, you know, what I really need to do is connect with these people. Why? What is special about those native people? Is it the amount of time that they've been here? Or as you suggest, you said that there's a deeper spiritual connection, but it also implies that there are these different spirit groups, that you have your spirit groups, native Washington,
right,
native people, and we have our spirit groups, but they are somehow linked or connected. I mean, they didn't ask you, Jan, to say, and Jan, we of course want to connect with your spirits too and make sure that it's okay for us to be there.
They're very pragmatic. It wouldn't matter. They want to talk to the people who know who the spirits of this land have been, you know, from the beginning of time, the people that have contact. So it's out of courtesy. Hello. Their whole approach to life is it's all the guest-host relationship. So they are guests here, and there's a certain kind of spiritual and or social propriety that's necessary. And so they go, okay, who are the people around here that really have can tell us about who the spirits of the land and water of nature? Well, it's the indigenous people. So they go and they ask permission. We're going to do this. We don't want to offend you, and we don't want to offend your spirits. Do we have your permission to call our spirits over from Siberia to join us here while we do our work?
Fair enough. I don't want to drill into it because I think I'm kind of getting us off track. But I mean, they didn't ask you to crack open the yellow pages and call up mediums or anything like that. Or they didn't ask you to take you over to SRI and go talk to a researcher who's worked with mediums who connect with spirits. You know, they have a different, why one spirit versus another spirit? And from a practical standpoint, you know, what are they saying there? The time is also of interest. You know, you said that the spirits that are connected with this land over the longest period of time, what does that say about their understanding of time? People like you and I come to question the idea of time and is it really linear and all the rest of that. And yet they're kind of putting it on a kind of linear time frame there. Any thoughts?
Not necessarily. They what we know scientifically to be true is that the only things that really exist in nature are cycles and rhythms. Now, we have things like clocks, and we have time, and we have latitude and longitude, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And those are social conventions, and calendars, and they're great, and they're useful, but it doesn't make them real. The Ulchi see time as everything, as in all and most indigenous cultures, I can't speak for all, and very much like the Taoist, everything is cyclic. Everything is in a cycle. A medium may interact with personal spirits. I don't know who the spirits are that they're interacting with, but there's all levels of spirits. There's all kinds of spirits. The Ulchi say, look, we're in your land. Who are the land spirits? Right? Who are the spirits of this place? There is a hierarchy of spirits, but it's not as though one is necessarily in charge of the other. It's more a really true meritocracy. So they're interested, you know, it's like everybody has the sun, everybody has the moon. Okay, these are the big, big cosmic spirits that the whole world has. But when you start getting to certain areas of the land or the water, that there's kind of a secondary, there are other spirits that control that. And then there are spirits under those spirits under those spirits. A medium may work with his or her own spirits that guide them and give them information, but they aren't the bigger spirits. They aren't the land spirits.
Have you ever talked to the Ulchi about, for example, what people are experiencing through this near-death experience that we talk about a lot here? And I know there's a lot of different cultures, the Tibetan culture, and I read it in your book, you know, this, I don't want to say it's not an underworld because they don't call it an underworld, but this afterlife world. What is our relationship with that after bodily death?
Now, that's a great question. Here's something that I don't think anybody's ever thought of or been aware of. They talk a lot about ancestors, right? People talk about ancestors, and shamans do this ancestral worship. The Ulchi don't. This is what they believe. You're going to like this, especially when it comes to past lives. They believe that we're here for a limited amount of time, and we're really lucky to be here. And that we should, and if you really want to experience the world, or the best way of experiencing the world in a more accurate way is by using your senses and using your nervous system and using how you've and thinking about how something feels, not just emotionally, but somatically. So they believe we're here for a certain amount of time. It's a great gift to be on this planet, you know, but we're passing through. You know, we're lucky. We've reincarnated here. We will come and go, but nature is eternal. Now, once we pass on, they say that the transition into that next world could take a year or so. So you're transitioning, and then they have their whole ceremony about offering food and clothing to this person for that year-long transition. Well, once that's done, they have big cultural taboos about you can't use a person's name anymore, and you can't do this, and you can't do that, and you don't want to think about them. If they show up to you in a dream and they come visit you, that's great, but you have to let them go. And it's because after you die, that wherever you end up going, you're going to be there for thousands of years, whatever this new thing is. And that if you, and as you start to go into that new life on the other world, if you were to call them back, it would be very rude. It would be calling them back to a life that they're no longer connected to. It's like saying, what, you know, it would be like in the next world, you're asking them to come back and relive a past, it would be their past life. So you never call on them. You let them go. If they visit you, that's great. They may visit you for a while and they'll disappear, but they've moved on to their next life.
How would you personally reconcile that with this idea of the love connection? Because when you look at the NDE literature and you look at some of the after-death communication literature, what comes through in that data, if you will, is that it's the love, the bond that we form with these other souls that does bring us back, and that the after-death communication says that these folks are looking down on us, that the ancestors are here and they're here for a long time. So I know this goes against what the Ulchi is saying, and maybe it doesn't. Maybe it can be reconciled in the way that you're saying that the Ulchi say, well, just that may be true, but don't pull them in. Don't bug them so that they can get on with their own stuff. But what do you make of the love connection in general and that in particular?
I agree with the love connection in regards to the Ulchi say that the truest person that is most natural is a human-hearted person. And that's what they classify, but they'll never get into, they're like Confucius, they'll never get into explaining what that means. They do believe that special people, people that were exceptional in their culture, do ascend beyond and go to a realm that they do become kind of clan protectors or ancestors, but they do believe that you would have to have had a very exceptional life not to get into that realm and not end up just sort of going on to, you know, your next journey, this next life you're going to go to. They believe that in this other world, you're going to have a long life there, 2,000 or 3,000 years. And then once you're there, you die there and then you're reborn again. And you could come back to this planet, or you could go be an ET on another planet. Who knows where you're going to be reborn? You could be anywhere.
What do you make, and this always fascinates me, is the reincarnation thing. One of the things I think is interesting about that is when you try and pin it down culturally, mm-hmm. you wind up with some very specific differences in what people believe.
Right.
Like what you just said right there is something really kind of specific that doesn't go into other cultures. Other cultures say, hey, reincarnation, it only happens 3 times. Or you have 15 times. Or right. The interval between times is, you know, 50 years or 100 years. Or like you just said, thousands of years. And then you go look at, you know, Jim Tucker, even Ian Stevenson at University of Virginia. And they said, gosh darn it, let's try and study it this scientific way. And now we have this kid who is born in the 80s or 90s. And he's remembering vivid memories of World War II fighter pilot or another kid. So what do you make of that data? And in general, what do we do when we have data that comes back that contradicts other data? in this extended consciousness realm thing? Because again, we're having this conversation, Jim.
I think this is great. If you try, first of all, you have to be comfortable with ambiguity. You know, if I tried to pin down the Ulti with anything, they'd say, go, is that really true? They go, well, I don't know. We haven't been there yet. Who knows? Be open. Keep an open mind. This is what we've heard. Some people say this, some people say this, some people they say that, but we haven't been there. Be open to everything. So all this NDE and reincarnation, I listen to it, I watch it, I'm aware of the University of Virginia's research, I'm aware of, you know, I looked at the work by Robert John and Brenda Dunn, It's fantastic. Who knows? That's what makes the journey, that, you know, it's not, that's what makes everything so wonderful and exciting, is that we're, you know, and yes, it's going to be contradictory. Who knows? Just keep on going. Let's find out what we can find out. Science isn't wrong. It's just incomplete.
Well said. Right.
And I love all the new stuff that's coming. I mean, I listen to the people that come on your show and it's like, wow, that's another idea. I don't say, this is not about making people wrong. You know, the only people I think are wrong in any of this are the hardcore materialistic scientists. When given evidence that is in flat contradiction to what they're saying, rather than being true scientists about it, which a lot of them have come that way and said, wow, here's some new data. Let's go check this out. I was mistaken. Let's go here. You know, those are the true scientists. The other ones, you know, that go, no, it can't be possible, and we don't care about all your research studies, and I don't care if you did a triple blind test and blah, 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 blah. You're wrong, wrong, wrong. That kind of arrogant attitude by those people, those people are wrong. Everybody else, yeah, everybody else is just exploring and discovering and adding and working hard and, you know, to add to our knowledge base. And that's so exciting.
Yeah, yeah. I always like the, you know, not even wrong kind of thing. So to me, there's nothing wrong with being wrong. I'm wrong all the time. I celebrate other people are wrong. What I have a hard time tolerating are the folks who are not even wrong, like not even in the ballpark of talking about the same thing. So like you're saying, if you think consciousness is an epiphenomenon of the brain, it's not that you're wrong. It's you're not even wrong in the sense of we can't begin to have this conversation. And I think that to me is also interesting back to what we're saying about this secret knowledge kind of thing and secret society thing, because I think there's a little clue there that these cultures are leaving for us. And one of my interpretations of that is that you're just going to only get so far with certain people who are not indoctrinated or not passing the litmus test or not getting to that level. And I love what you said just about how they deal with different beliefs. And they go, well, you know, hey, could be this, could be this. That seems like an advanced way of thinking about this stuff that isn't super interested in engaging with stuff that people who haven't even gotten to the first leg of the journey, you know?
Right. Well, they say, even for Westerners, they would always say, go listen to what everybody has to say. Go out there, explore, listen to what people have to say. You'll either, you know, it's important to always be in an open frame of mind. But they will also say intuitively, instinctually, you're going to feel, no, I'm not quite sure about this. And that those are the keys to understanding, is that you go, well, maybe, I don't know. I just get this funny feeling that those feelings are very important.
Jan, what do you think is the most significant personal transformation that you've had through your encounter with the Ulti?
My most personal would be, I'm a great skeptic, Alex. So when these people first came here, I always said, yeah. Okay, prove it to me.
Come to my bookstore and share the ideas, but I'm not really buying into
it. You know, I'm not buying into this. It's like, okay, you prove it to me. You prove it to me. I'm going to sit back there and be an ignorant, stupid person. as I said, noticing how these people are in the world and noticing how the world responds to them, especially with nature encounters that I had with them, it's pretty magical. They're just amazing, magical people, all sorts of, every time I was with them, there would be some sort of anomalous event that would go on inside my home, or something would happen, or we would go somewhere and I would, you know, watch these people walk into a room and blow out all the lights, you know, in the studio, or this would happen, and it would like, okay, like right on cue, things would happen. So it was just amazing to watch them. They are truly, you know, they are truly Yoda. They are truly Dr. Doodle when it comes to being able to just seamlessly interact with nature and watch nature respond to them. And when I would see that, I would think, I don't know what that is, but I want to learn that. I want to hang around these people and really try to go, how is this being done? What are they doing? How are they being that is causing these responses to them?
Has it led to you having any direct connection with the spirit world that you weren't able to have before?
It's deepened my connection and my dreams, because there's no difference between the spirit world and your dream world. That's one thing to be aware, that the spirit world is the dream world. And we all go there every night. You don't have to go spend a lot of money and buy classes to learn how to be there. You're there every night. It's natural.
What about folks who have, and I've talked to several of them on this show, who have explored the astral realm and would maybe pick that apart a little bit and say they're very similar, but there is a astral world where your body is more removed from that dream state. Would that be inconsistent with what either you've experienced or with what the Ulchi are telling us?
No, because they're always shapeshifting.
So shapeshifting out of the dream world into the astral world where you're going and visiting other people.
Well, they can be in their bodily form in these dream worlds or astral worlds or whatever, or they can be in another form, or they can be little dots of light. It's whatever they choose to be.
What has been the process for you in terms of learning to deepen your dreams, learning to deepen your ability to access that lucid dreaming thing? Is there anything you can pass along to other people in terms of what that process has been like for you?
Just pay attention. It's not a technique. Just, you know, it's just saying, okay, when I go to bed tonight, I'm going to remember my dreams, or I'm going to do this, or just keeping it circulating in your conscious, that at night when you go to sleep, you go there, we all go there, we all go through the state, it's natural, and that at some point, you know, if you wake up in the dream, then you can begin to explore a little bit more in this world. But I'm always working on it. I have lots of students that I've been seeing for years, and they're much better at this than I am.
Talk a little bit about how you help people in various ways through your practice.
Well, I have students, and I teach classes on this very specific form of classical shamanism, and I just impart to them what the Ulchi say. I try to remind them that it's important not to get into the intellectual realm once an experience is. If once you have an experience, just sit there and feel what that's all about. That will be much more informative than getting into trying to make meaning out of it. I don't teach people, but I just try to remind people that they naturally have these skills and that people need to trust themselves. And that's what it all comes down to. People don't trust themselves.
We'll definitely in the show notes hook people up with, again, your website, which is excellent, just so beautifully done.
Thank you.
If you did that, or if you had some other folks do it, but it's really pretty remarkable. I was really impressed. So we definitely want to connect people with that. Do you think, Jan, that there was a reason for the Ulchi to connect with you here in the West in Washington?
Who knows? Maybe yes, maybe no. Who's to say?
Did you ever ask them?
I've asked them a few times, and I'm going, "Oh, why are you here?" "Oh, well, because our spirits sent, you know, our spirits talk to your spirits, and so you took up the banner, and it was like, okay, that's great, okay, wonderful. I mean, who knows? And Alex, I was going to say, those aren't the questions I ask myself. I'm still asking, okay, how is it done? Like you, I'm going, is there a technique? Is it this? Is it this? Is it this? Is it this? It's like, how are these people able to be the way they are in the world? And you're in a house with them and things start flying around. Cups and saucers that'll fly around in the house, or lights get exploded. You're out with them in nature and things start to happen. You know, wild animals come up to you. Or you're downstairs in a sealed room and they're talking about the north wind and everything is sealed and locked, and suddenly there's a wind in the middle of the room. It's like, I'm still in the how is that done, and I know that I'm probably too Western in my approach, because I don't know if I'll ever know the how. I think it's about being in a certain state of consciousness, and I don't know. I'll always be asking that question till I'm gone. And but that's what, you know, that's what encourages me to wake up every morning and to keep, you know, to keep on the adventure and to keep exploring and to see what I come up with.
I do have to say, I think that's wonderful. I think you're one of these transitional people. And I don't know if I'm answering my own question a minute ago, but I don't think a lot of people can really feel comfortable with one foot in both these worlds as you do, because obviously you are deeply interested in the deeper spiritual aspects of this, but at the same time, you're bringing that scientific, break it apart, deconstruct it, where's your iPhone kind of vibe kind of thing. And then on the third leg, you're saying, of course, none of that matters or means anything anyway, but...
Well, of course. I mean, I'm trying to really understand them and their planet and bring it back and translate it. It's like I'm going to Planet Ulchi, and I've come back, and Planet Ulchi is not like, trust me, it's not like the West at all. So I'm trying to come back to our planet and try to explain how these aliens from Planet Ulchi, how they exist, how they, their view of logic, their view of how things happen. And I'm trying to use my, having grown up in a Western culture, to look at the science and look at the medical data and say, well, you know, the closest I can get to, and come up with examples. If I give a bunch of philosophical abstractions, it's not going to make any sense. It's best to give examples. So it's me talking about REM sleep behavior disorder and this and this and this, and that's the closest I can get to explaining the phenomena. Nobody has said that. And anybody in the West has ever said that's what it is. I'm the first person saying everything that I know, this is what it correlates to. So when, if you want to go have a shamanic journey, I don't know, they talk about the shamanic state of consciousness, I think, what the hell is that? That's so vague. And I mean, it's like, what do you mean? There's no such thing as, there's just consciousness.
Before we run out of time here, and I appreciate all this, because it's been such a great conversation. I love how you're so willing to go all these different places. One of the things you teased me with in an awesome way, because you know my kind of skeptical vibe, is this understanding that you've come to have about how shamanism / neo-shamanism was co-opted in, not in a secret shadow government kind of way, but in a much more understandable kind of huckster, let's make a buck kind of way. Do you want to talk about any of that and about some of your feelings about what's going on with shamanism as it's portrayed in the West often and how it's been commercialized? Or it may be whether some of that maybe is okay and maybe some of it is not okay.
Right. Well, I try to, you know, I would go from being very sad to very angry and come to a state of just like, okay, it is what it is. There, you have core shamanism that was created by Michael Harner, and you have Carlos Castaneda, and then you have neo-shamanism and all these Western interpretations of the art. And shamanism is not a technique, it's an art. And their ideas about shamanic states of consciousness or this and this, I don't know where they're coming from. I don't understand what they're talking about because...
Well, I think you go one step further and you say you question whether they've legitimately come up with that information or whether they've just kind of plagiarized it and borrowed it in order to make a buck.
Well, I don't know if I would go so far maybe to say a buck. I think that all these people that have created it, I think on the most part, they're very sincere about their studies, but you're not going to learn a tradition from either running around the world and taking bits and pieces of unrelated cultures and throwing it together and creating a technique or coming up with a structure that you've read from books. I mean, I can't believe that people are even still reading Iliad. I mean, everybody should have an Iliad book burning weekend. People use that as a prime source, and that's crazy. Everything is being interpreted from either neo-shamanism or core shamanism, from a very Western, mechanistic, linear, reductionistic point of view. And I completely disagree with that.
Well, let me approach it from another direction.
Okay.
Shamanism in our culture right now, probably most prominent in the ayahuasca ceremonies in Peru, the either, you know, entheogen travel community, you know, get your shaman, go out in the woods, do a little ceremony. What do you think about that?
What, the misuse of plant spirits versus people that really...
Is it a misuse?
Oh, well, maybe not. Yeah, I don't...
Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is. I mean, is that genuine shamanism? How do you find a real shaman? How do you know if you should enter into the ritual and have that experience? I mean, can one say that at least we're now starting to embrace that culture, even if it is in this clumsy, problematic way, we're at least engaging with a different paradigm that says there is this other world that we can connect with and are connected with whether we want to be or not. I mean,
right.
There are some positives, right? So there's also some negatives.
Well, the Ulchi didn't have mushrooms and other hallucinatory plant teachers in their area, although the Chukchi people that live to the north do. But all sorts of plants, they don't have a problem with those, the idea that there are plant teachers. I mean, the Ulchis ate marijuana every morning for breakfast.
Back in Russia?
Yeah, Ulchi land. I mean, that was...
Well, then that's a psychedelic.
Yeah. They, you know, they collected hemp seed, marijuana seed all the time. And I've actually tried to discover exactly which strain of marijuana grows up there, and the information's not real clear, but it is some sort of indica strain. But they ate that; they ate that every day.
What about back to shamanism as it's reemerging in our culture? The good, the bad, the ugly.
My concern with core shamanism and neo shamanism, and the Ulchi had exposure to this when the over the years that they were here, is a lot of what these people are doing that is very dangerous. So that's the thing, that's the aspect of made up shamanism that concerns me.
Dangerous in what way? This is like we're 2 hours into this and now we've hit on a really important point.
Well, for example, in core shamanism, they have their techniques, and then they have this drumming at 247 beats per minute, which is, according to these people, put you in a shamanic state of consciousness, some whatever, and you travel there. And then at the end, they have what they call a callback, where it's an abrupt ending to whatever that trance state is, and when people are called back. The Ulchis saw that and experienced that when they were teaching for the shamanic, for the Foundation for Shamanic Studies one year. They saw that happening and they were shocked. They said that that could cause a trauma to the soul. They thought it was very barbaric, and those are the terms I will use because that is a quote from them. And after they had that experience, they wanted to get up and leave. And then I had to convince them that we had signed a legal contract and that we couldn't get up and leave for a week and that it would all come back on me. And so I'm sorry that you've had this experience. I'm so sorry. And they went to address that. And later on, it was a week-long event. They went to address that with the people that they saw.
See, so that again, like we're connected in that way, Jan, you and I, in terms of understanding the mechanics of it. Because now we're getting into a very much of a value judgment. Hey, there's a right way to do it. There's a wrong way to do it. Or if you like, there's a more effective way to do it, a more elegant way to do it, and a less elegant way to do it. Well, what is that saying? And then let me tie that back to something you were saying earlier about the hierarchy of consciousness, another one of my kind of key things. Well, there's these souls who are on this level, but then there's souls who are on another level. I mean, these are all little hints to mapping out this territory, this topology, in a way that then again contradicts with, I mean, if none of it matters, then who cares if you enter in the astral body this way and enter back into it that way? Who cares? Whatever you want to do. But then they say, well, hey, I really wouldn't recommend doing it that way. Or what do they say about evil spirits or malevolent spirits? I mean, these are all different areas we could get into, but it kind of contradicts that Taoism, it's all going to be okay, it doesn't matter anyway kind of thing.
Well, no, Taoism is not a passive philosophy at all or a passive way of life.
Right,
Yes, you can get into that state of saying, well, it doesn't really matter in the bigger scheme of things. And maybe that's true. Maybe that's absolutely true, Alex. But at the same time, you don't want to say, oh, I'm going to show you how to shoot a gun, and then you load the gun, and then you give it to an ignorant person that doesn't know anything, and you say, okay, here, put the nose of the gun toward you and pull the trigger. There is a responsibility on the part of any teacher. I mean, I can get into that. I mean, I can get into, you know, is it somebody that's teaching something, if they don't know specifically what they're doing, they could cause more harm than good.
Jan, again, you've written this awesome book, Spirits from the Edge of the World. Where do you go from here in terms of your work and your investigation and ongoing relationship with the Ulche people?
Well, since all of the shamans have gone on to wherever they've gone on to, I've got 25 years of all of the healing work that my main teacher, Grandmother Nadia Duvan, did with people here in the West. So I've got 450, 500 hours of information, of all of her healing work with all of her different clients. And what I'm going to do right now, what I'm doing with that is translating it, and I'm going to put together some sort of quantitative study of the actual healing process and what the correlates were. I haven't come up with all the criteria for that yet, but I'm going to translate all of that. And so that's my next big research project.
Awesome. Well, it's been great. Like I said, I really appreciate your willingness to kind of go all these different directions.
Right. I apologize if times you were here and I was here and I was like,
No, please. Most people don't wind up feeling kind of uncomfortable with that. And you were there with me every step of the way. And I think we got to a lot of the stuff that really will compel people to want to go out and get this book and check out your website, because they should. This deep dive is so important in terms of I'm talking to someone who really knows shit that other people don't know. And I think is always such a big plus for me because, like you said, people who just have compiled a bunch of stuff isn't as rich as somebody who says, hey, I've really dug into it. You know, that amount of time you spent on it is just incredible.
Well, I think very much like you, Alex, we're seeking the truth as much as we can get to it. And that the only way, and you as well, to really do, you can't go anywhere and really come up with any real information without the in-depth research. Most people have information a mile long and one inch deep.
Right.
And so, you know, you've got to go deep. You've got to go deep to get all the possible variables. But then again, Alex, I don't know. When you get all that, I don't know if you could ever take all the possible variables into consideration when you go to make a hypothesis or a theory about something.
Of course not. Of course not. It's just a different kind of conversation. And that's what you've treated us to today, Jan. So again, I thank you so much for doing it. Our guest has been Jan Van Isselstein. And the book, one more time, is Spirits from the Edge of the World. Jan, thanks so much.
You're the best. I thank you so very much. It has made my year to be on your broadcast. So I thank you so, so very much.
You're way, way too kind.
Oh, no, no, no.
Thanks again to Jan for joining me today on Skeptico. The question I'd ask you is the question I asked Jan. Where's your fucking iPhone? More broadly, what is the connection between extended consciousness and technology in all forms, including ET, NDE, OBE, and any other three-letter acronym you can come up with? This is a deep dive. This is the kind of stuff that still gets my Skeptico juices flowing. And I hope it does yours too. Join me in this dialogue. Come visit me on skeptico.com. Engage with the material and let me know how you're doing, how you're thinking, and how you're handling these tough questions. While you're there, check out all the previous episodes of Skeptico. Take them all, use them how you like. They're all available there for free. And then, of course, stay with me for future shows, many of them coming up. But until then, take care and bye for now.